the U.S. at war with Iran.
We're going to destroy their missiles and raise their missile industry to the ground. It will be totally, again, obliterated.
What does it mean for Iranians in Cincinnati trying to reach family in their homeland? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Zach Carrion, filling in for Lucy May. Today on the News Review, Iranian Americans, their thoughts on the U.S.-Israeli strikes, plus 9 people injured in a nightclub shooting. We look at the trend lines in recent years. And Kroger's new CEO, what has he said about pricing? I'm joined now by Cincinnati Inquirer reporters Cameron Knight and David Ferrara. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Zach.
So let's just get right into it with this shooting. Cameron, what do we know about what happened at Riverfront Live before the shooting? What was the event there?
So there was, it's a nightclub. There was one of the things they were hosting that night was a birthday celebration for an artist named DJ Fresh. His actual name is Jermaine Tandy. He's based out of Louisville. And seems like there were between 400 and 800 people there, depending on who you ask. Some officials are saying like 500 to 600. Some are saying as high as 800. And it was just a crowded nightclub. And at some point, there were gunshots, lots of them.
And I mean, hundreds of people in a crowded nightclub like that. That sounds like a pretty chaotic scene. David, can you describe what it was like in there? What do you know about what happened during the shooting?
Absolutely. So this is one of Cincinnati's, you know, in the scheme of things, largest live music venues. Huge space. You got capacity for 1,300 on the inside. And as Cam was saying, a lot of folks in there that night. The scene was busy. As far as I've heard from both seeing videos online and seeing people flooding out after the shooting had begun, you had a lot of folks inside. There was, as the owner said, security in place, having people going through a metal detector, having people getting wanded down as they were entering into the building. And there were police that were stationed outside on special details, as well as the venue's own security. But it did seem like, as far as officials are saying, that the night was peaceful prior to the shooting breaking out shortly before 1 a.m.
And, you know, not everyone might be familiar with Riverfront Live, but certainly the venue itself has been around for a while. Can you talk a little bit about some of the background and history of this venue?
Absolutely. So a lot of Cincinnatians will remember Riverfront Live as what it used to be, which is Annie's. A long storied club going back many, many years, back to the 80s and 90s and all, known for its hard rock and metal concerts. And it did have some issues that got to Cincinnati City Council in the late 2010s and ended up leading to the revocation of its liquor license after there were different allegations that were made regarding activities, alleged criminal activities going on at the club. And it did have different iterations, different stints. It was also Inner Circle and Stage 43 at one point. So you did have different names that spun off it before it got shut down. And then Tim Jordan, who's now the current owner of Riverfront Live, bought the property, decided to clean it up and take a new approach.
And, you know, in situations like these, when they first happen, there's a lot of unclear information, a lot of things that aren't yet confirmed. Now we're a few days removed from that. So, you know, either one of you guys, how many people were shot during this? And also, were there additional injuries? Because I heard some people were trampled as well, right?
Yeah. So there were 9 people shot in the incident. At least one of those people has now been charged, it appears, according to his attorney. There have been 2 people charged in the shooting. One of them is also a person who was shot. And then there were, we talked to the victim's advocate at the Cincinnati Police Department, and she said that she'd been hearing of around 20 people who suffered injuries due to trampling getting flooded out. All of the shooting victims survived, including the person who's also been charged. I think almost all of them have been released from the hospital at this point, but all of their injuries were expected to be, they weren't life-threatening injuries for any of them.
Right. As of earlier this week, there are 2 people still in the hospital, one of which, according to his attorney, is the shooter. And then those trampling injuries, again, you know, the surveillance camera footage that I saw was people flooding out of this bar out of all possible exits. And according to the victim's advocate, Karen Rumsey, she was telling me that people have reported, you know, injuries from getting trampled upon, their arms getting swollen when they fell to the ground. One girl, she said, had tried to escape out the outdoor patio, and there's a barbed wire fence. So she climbed over the fence and ended up cutting up her hands on the barbed wire trying to get out.
And, you know, you talked about, David, earlier, the security at this venue and the, you know, police and metal detectors. Have they figured out how someone managed to bring a weapon in, even with all of that security there?
That's the question of the hour. The owner still says that he's looking into it and he wants to know how a weapon made it through. I mean, I did see some of the security apparatus. He took us, another media, on sort of a tour the morning after the shooting to see what the premises looked like. And, you know, there was one of those stationary metal detectors, not as advanced as the one he'd seen in an airport, but, you know, the classic one you see at concert venues and all. And then he said that they were winding people down and doing pat downs and such. So it's unclear right now how a weapon made it inside. But according to federal court documents, there were two weapons that they've identified. One was a Taurus 9mm pistol, which typically smaller size concealed carry pistol. And another was a 45 caliber pistol.
And we mentioned the two men that have been arrested, the suspects in this shooting. What do we know about these two, and what charges are they facing right now?
So one of them has been charged with a single count of felonious assault. In court, they said that he had seen his longtime rival, they had a longstanding grudge, and he had spotted him across the crowd or whatever, and he just pulled out a gun and started shooting at him. He was not struck in the gunfire. He appeared in court already, and he's being held in jail. And the other person, the lawyer for the first person who allegedly fired first, according to prosecutors, his lawyer is claiming he fired in self-defense. So she didn't give a narrative or anything like that, but she claimed her client was firing in self-defense. The second person who's been charged, who's still in the hospital at this point, I think is still currently only facing a single count of felonious assault. But they haven't appeared in court yet because they're in the hospital. Attorney Clyde Bennett is representing that person, and Clyde Bennett has come out and said that his client acted in self-defense as well. And then in addition to all of that, both of them have prior felony convictions. So if they were in possession of a gun, they would be breaking the law just by having a gun at all, let alone in a nightclub. And they are both facing federal charges on top of the state charges for felonious assault. The reason behind that is that in Ohio, the state law does not punish carrying a handgun as a felon as stiffly as the federal laws do. So the federal laws are used to potentially keep the person behind bars for longer than the state law would.
So both kind of claiming self-defense, at least initially here, and now some potentially heavier federal charges could be on the way. That's what we're looking at.
Yeah.
Now. And so Mayor Pureval spoke at a press conference this week, and this is how he summed up this violence.
This brings up the real conversation around whether or not it is too easy to get a gun in our community, whether or not our laws make it so easy to get a gun in our community that a lot of people have guns. Coupled with the fact that they refuse to deal with disagreements peacefully, to the extent that they not only refuse to deal with disagreements peacefully, but they immediately run to mortal danger. As you can imagine, our law enforcement leaders, our city leaders, are very, very focused on what we can do to prevent people from getting access to guns, holding people accountable who engage in this kind of violence. But it is a very challenging issue to solve.
So, David, can you tell us more about his response. What was the point he was trying to make there?
Right. So this has been something that the mayor and other city officials have been talking about for quite some time, and especially within the given context of crime in downtown Cincinnati, just because last year there's been a lot of car thefts, particularly with the police saying that juveniles were breaking in and stealing guns. And again, that access to guns on the streets has been something that's been a priority to try and get people to exercise good gun ownership and make sure that those aren't getting in the hands of people that then might end up using them in crimes. And while it's still unclear whether these weapons were reported stolen and that's the necessary chain, I think that the mayor was getting at that to some degree in the press conference and was echoed by the city manager. And I think another part of it as well is, you know, you've had similar shootings coming up recently. You had the Spotlight Lounge shooting, which by, you know, we're still working to get additional information as police continue their investigation. But initial witness accounts and statements from the management indicate that there was some disagreement that devolved and ended up in a shooting in which bystanders got involved. Two people died, two people were injured. Similarly, at the Privy nightclub in Over the Rhine off Elm Street, you had another shooting breakout, two shootings breakout in November, where a total of seven people were shot. And these shootings seem to stem from disagreements where, again, the access to firearms is what's allowing it to turn into a violent situation that not only impacts the intended target, but these bystanders in crowded areas as well.
Oh, go ahead.
And the other part of this, too, is that over the past 7, 10, 15 years, Ohio's gun laws have steadily changed. At first, we had concealed carry permits being allowed, and then we've now had what's so-called constitutional or permitless carry law passed more recently. And on top of that, you've gotten changes to self-defense laws with a so-called stand your ground law being passed in Ohio as well. And as this with the state house and the state government largely being Republican controlled, Puroval and other Democratic leaders in the major cities in Ohio have felt like their hands have been tied because there is a preemption law in Ohio that bars cities from passing gun laws, essentially. So while they feel like they have their police to go solve crimes and things like that, a lot of the politicians feel like their hands are tied because they are unable to take any legislative action against guns. And Cincinnati's tried. It's not for trying. They have passed laws restricting guns and, you know, safe storage and things like that. And they almost always get sued and they always lose. So they have this preemption law is pretty strong and it makes it so that legislatively they don't have a lot of wiggle room in what they can do in terms of laws with guns.
And, you know, I think people have different ideas and solutions for this. So how did people react to what the mayor says about this issue and generally how he addresses crime?
That's been an ongoing saga for the past year. I mean, there was a lot of talk about crime last summer. That was not specifically gun crime. People were more concerned with sort of safety in downtown and being able to go do things and enjoy the city's attractions without big fights breaking out and things like that. And as this has all gone on, the mayor has placed the police chief on leave. She's still on leave now. You know, there's been back and forth about what should be done about all of this. And overall, I mean, it's been a heated issue. It was a very heated issue with the mayoral election in November. Mayor Puroval, you know, won that election handily. So it's still an ongoing thing.
And the immediate aftermath of this, too, I think there was and still remains a bit of questions to be answered about the bond and the way the charges have been laid out. You know, as Cam was saying earlier, right now on the state level, both defendants in the shooting only face one charge of felonious assault. And it's unclear why that is the case, you know, why additional charges haven't been brought yet and what is to come on the state side. And then because of that, and Cam, you were there for the arraignment earlier this week, you know, Municipal Court Judge Bernard Mundy during Frenny Cobb's arraignment said, well, I only see one charge of felonious assault, so I'm going to have to set your bond at $50,000. And I know that there was some outcry from different city leaders and politicians and folks in talking, including the mayor and Cam jump in, you know, just saying that why is the bond so low when nine people got shot?
Right. Yeah, and there and the judge explained that it was only one charge. There's also options for there were, you know, obviously the police could have brought more charges, or the prosecutor could have pushed for a higher bond or even a no bond hearing. There's a whole mechanism for that to keep the guy in jail. So yeah, there has been some question about bond. That is, again, an ongoing issue that people have been very critical of for the past, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years almost. People have been really bringing up the fact that they feel like there's low bonds in the city. And there's been just as much pushback from the other side saying that cash bonds don't keep people safe. So that's an ongoing political debate.
We are here talking with Cameron Knight and David Ferraro, reporters from the Cincinnati Inquirer. We're talking about the shooting at Riverfront Live. There have also been recent shootings like we brought up earlier on last month, the shooting at Spotlight Lounge in Northside. What do we know about that incident, and what has since happened to that club, and could Riverfront Live potentially have a similar fate?
Right. So Spotlight Lounge is an interesting case. So like I was saying before, you had two people shot who were killed and two people shot who were injured. It seems like that shooting occurred outside of the bar. Initial witness accounts and the owner and such like that are saying that there was some sort of fight that broke out inside the bar. Security separated the two folks, and then they ended up encountering each other again outside. And there were people that got struck in the crossfire, as well as possibly one of the intended targets. Again, that is still unclear, varying witness accounts. However, you know, in the case of the Spotlight Lounge, that bar had been open since right before COVID or so. And there had been residents in the area had been complaining about noise and complaining about, you know, public intoxication, people drinking in the parking lot adjacent to the bar. And the bar is actually renting out the space from a landlord, Oliver Kroner. And that I spoke with Oliver after the shooting, and he said that they agreed with the bar to terminate the lease after the shooting. So Spotlight Lounge is closing because the landlord no longer wanted to rent out to them. The case with Riverfront Live, as far as I understand, you know, it's not a rental situation where, you know, there's kind of dynamic there where the landlord might come around and say, yeah, this is too much risk for me, or I don't want to engage with this. And as far as I know, speaking with the owner of Riverfront Live, Tim Jordan, you know, he said to me that, you know, this isn't the old Annie's. This isn't, you know, he's put different works in place and made it a strong attempt to avoid issues like this coming up, or issues that Annie's had in the past. And, you know, he told me that there hasn't been any other situations like this, fights or shootings or such like that at his bar since he took it over, Riverfront Live. And he plans on adjusting how they bring in promoters and bring in outside events like this birthday party going forward to avoid situations like this.
Mass shooting is a term we hear a lot these days. Cameron, I know you've looked into shootings with multiple victims over the past few years. First of all, can you kind of define what a mass shooting is, and what have you found related to that?
Sure. So there isn't everyone has a different definition of what a mass shooting is. There's an FBI, different groups have different definitions. Generally speaking, it's a situation where four or more people were shot. That's the simplest definition to use. And using that definition, in the past 6 years, there have been 12 people killed and 83 wounded in Cincinnati since the beginning of 2020. So that's 83 people shot and 12 people killed. Just in 6 years, based on the statistics kept by this national organization called the Gun Violence Database. And some of those shootings include the mass shooting at Fifth Third Tower, which was kind of an active shooter situation where someone just decided to open fire on the general public. There was the biggest mass shooting in Cincinnati's history, which had 17 victims. That was Cameo, which is just a mile away from Riverfront Live. It's on the same street right there. And that shooting had 17 victims. Then we've had drive-by shootings with 9 and 10 victims. We've had the Birds of Big Main Street shooting in 2022 with multiple victims. It's been an increasing issue. It's been a steady issue in our city for at least the last 6 years. So
that's Inquirer reporters Cameron Knight and David Ferrara. Always great to talk with you guys. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Up next, Iranians in Cincinnati discuss U.S. strikes. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Zach Carrion. Protests locally over U.S. airstrikes in Iran, but also celebration over the death of the supreme leader. How are local Iranians processing this war? I'm joined now by Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Patty Gallagher-Newberry. Always good to have you, Patty.
Thanks, Zach.
And WCPO reporter Marlena Lang. Welcome to the show, Marlena.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So let's get into it. Patty, U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran have drawn criticism and protests like the one we saw outside of City Hall earlier this week in Cincinnati. What was the sentiment you saw there?
So I understand it was mixed. I was not at that event, but I did read other news coverage. The majority of the people who showed up on Saturday morning, just really hours after the United States revealed that we had this active activity in Iran, most of them appeared to be anti-war, you know, with signs saying stay out of war, no more wars, etc. There were a few folks there, however, of Iranian descent who did express support for the removal of the supreme leader.
And Patricia, for Iranian-Americans, emotions are a little complex. You know, the country they call home, the U.S., is attacking a country where, you know, their descendants come from, where their family lives. So what have you heard about those concerns?
So I interviewed five or six local Iranians in the aftermath of the strikes beginning. And to a person, they support the idea, or they supported the U.S. involvement in removing the supreme leader. Not supportive of the regime that's been in place there for four decades. It's brought a lot of harm to their home countries. And I had a couple, however, who said, you know, that they felt conflicted, that their country was under attack, that there were bombings in their homeland, but at the same time, very happy that the United States played a role in removing Khamenei.
And like you mentioned, it's a complex situation, especially with the killing of the Ayatollah. Marlena, you spoke with an Iranian woman who teaches at UC about how she regards the war. We'll listen to her right now.
We have wanted this for such a long time. This is not a war with Iran. This is a war with terrorists. This is a war for Iranian people.
Yeah, so Marlena, what was she saying there? What was her kind of opinion of what's happening right now?
Yeah, I mean, very similar to what Patty was just saying. She had a very same feeling about the war. You know, just happy that the supreme leader had been killed. You know, just like Patty mentioned, they'd been under a regime that they did not like, that they felt oppressed under for the better part of 30, 40 years. And she was excited that, you know, this is hopefully going to bring change to her country and to leadership and, you know, freedom for her family and friends that are still back home.
And so similar sentiments there. The Persian American Society of Cincinnati organized an event over the weekend to commemorate Iranians harmed by the regime. What personal stories, Patty or Marlena, did you hear from people? What brought them here and how are they kind of feeling right now?
Right. So first of all, the Persian American Society had an event planned for Saturday evening that was to commemorate the loss of thousands of people killed in the streets of Iran as they protested the government in January. That death toll has been the estimates range from 7,000 to more than 30,000. And so they were coming together as a community in Greater Cincinnati, had this event planned for Mason to commemorate the loss. But coincidentally, you know, the United States-Israeli strike began that morning. And so what had been planned as a solemn event to commemorate the person's lost turned into a dual event that also celebrated the removal of the Ayatollah. So again, you know, people conflicted happy and sad at the same time and very concerned for their friends and family left behind, as Marlena just indicated.
Yeah. And Marlena, going back to the UC teacher, what was kind of her story about how, you know, she got here? Why did she leave Iran? And, you know, why are people continuing to leave?
Yeah. So Farazana is the woman I interviewed. So she grew up right during that Islamic revolution. She was 10 years old when that happened and the Ayatollah first took over. And her dad was a prominent supporter of the Shah, which means he was looked at as an opponent to the Ayatollah. So a lot of her childhood was fear that her dad would be executed. And then again, just going back to the regime that they were under, she felt oppressed. So she finally made her way to the U.S. A bit later in life, but she came to join her husband. He moved here for his career and education. And, you know, she's enjoyed it. She had the same feelings as happy that the U.S. did take a role in the war, but also just struggling with those feelings of, you know, making sure her family and friends back in Iran are safe. But she told me something that even though they are being constantly bombarded, they too are happy that the supreme leader is dead and that change is hopefully coming.
Well, some happiness and, of course, some concern. Patty, have you been talking to people who have been trying to maintain contact with loved ones and family in Iran? And are they having issues? What challenges are they facing right now?
So one of the tools of the regime has been cutting out communication, shutting down the internet, making phone communication difficult. And so that happened beginning Saturday. And some of the folks that I talked to had not been able to reach their families. And I was a little bit surprised at how nonplussed they were by that. But I think that they're used to these kinds of interruptions imposed by the government. So two people in particular said they had not been able to reach their families. One gentleman said he was taking hope in the fact that the strikes were being directed at military targets and not civilians, although I think we know some civilians have been collateral damage. And another said she was not able to reach family as they moved from Tehran north to her mother's home in the mountains. But again, seemed like, well, I'm sure I'll be able to reach them. I have confidence that they are safe. So just kind of accepting the realities on the ground there.
And Marlena, have you been hearing similar things as well?
Yes. When I spoke to Farzana, I believe it was last week or this past Monday, she told me that they were communicating with family and friends all weekend. But as of Monday, they were blacked out and she couldn't communicate with them. But same as Patty just said, she seemed very okay with it. She's used to it and had hope and, you know, faith that they were safe and okay.
And, you know, certainly the opinions are not monolithic. And considering the political leanings of Iranians here in Cincinnati, Patty, can you speak to a little bit about this, how they feel about the political situation also here in the U.S. with their involvement? Trump is ramping up the pressure overseas. How has this changed how they view the administration, or has it changed how they view it?
I believe it has. One of the people I interviewed indicated that most Iranians in Cincinnati would be leaning liberal, and that would be, you know, before their country became a target of these strikes, but that some people now are vocalizing support for Donald Trump because he is the, you know, the man in the chair right now who made the decision to go in and remove the Ayatollah. So, you know, had one person call him a hero. And say that, you know, he's made all the difference in their country right now. So that's as much as I can say, but I don't think, you know, absent this current activity, we would have heard this kind of full-throated endorsement of Donald Trump from local Iranians.
And, you know, we don't know how this is going to play out, but Patty or Marlena, what are people's hopes for the future in their homeland? And how do they see U.S. military involvement actually playing out?
I know for Farzana, excuse me. She is very hopeful for the future of Iran and just the people in her country. She, you know, emphasized with me several times during our interview that she has unwavering faith, especially in the Gen Z population of Iran. She said that they are brave and resilient and that they are tuned in politically with what is happening. And she understands that obviously there will be tragedy, there will be death, as that comes with war, unfortunately. But at the end of the day, she truly believes that her people will become free because of this.
I've been speaking with The Enquirer's Patty Gallagher Newberry and WCPO's Marlena Long. Up next, FC Cincinnati talks expansion and Kroger's CEO talks prices. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Zach Carrion. Welcome back. The new CEO at Kroger's headquarters has some ideas about competitive pricing, and FC Cincinnati has some ideas about stadium expansion. Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter Steve Watkins is here to break it all down. Happy Friday, Steve.
Hey, thanks, Zach. Happy Friday to you.
Yeah, and thank you for being here. So let's get into the TQL Stadium expansion plans. So FC Cincinnati wants to expand the stadium. What exactly are they looking to add?
Yeah, there are quite a few different pieces to this, and they talk about expanding it, and it is expanding the footprint of the stadium. But it's not an expansion in the sense that a lot of people would probably think of, oh, they're going to add 10,000 seats or something like that. It's not anything near that. Basically, what they're doing is they will add some premium seating. Their chief revenue officer, Chad Munitz, told me it would be fairly minimal, were his words, in terms of the amount of new seats. Right now, the stadium seats about 25,000. It's 25,513. That'll change a little, but not dramatically. They're also going to do things like expanding restrooms, improving concourses and concessions, relocating the north gate to the stadium. And a lot of this is really aimed at integrating the stadium with the mixed-use project that they're planning right next to it. So those are a lot of the projects that they're planning.
Yeah, and you know, the stadium is still pretty new. So why does the team think this expansion is necessary right now?
Yeah, well, it was interesting because Jeff Birding, the co-CEO, said, well, the stadium's not as new as it used to be, which I guess is true for all of us. But the stadium opened in 2021. So it's now 5 years old. That's not old, obviously, by any means, but it has gotten some use. And as things develop in the stadium and sports world, new stadiums are coming on board around Major League Soccer. Miami, New York, and I believe Chicago are all adding new stadiums. They'll have new amenities. Premium seating, which brings in more revenue, is always a big thing. And so both Jeff Birding and Chad Munitz told me that they need to make sure they're keeping up with the rest of Major League Soccer as things develop. So that's the main aspect of the timing, or one of the main aspects, I guess, because the other one really is the idea of making sure that the stadium is integrated with this mixed use development. And Jeff Birding likened it to the Cincinnati Reds at Great American Ballpark, which people will be familiar with. The way their plaza works in integrating the stadium with the Reds Hall of Fame and the team store. They're all on the same site. People can access one from the other, but they can also access the Hall of Fame and team store from outside. So it's kind of that type of concept.
And, you know, something like this, it has to come with a pretty heavy price tag. I know FCC is requesting a state grant for these improvements. How much are they asking for, and where exactly is that money coming from?
That's right. My colleague Brian Planalp wrote early this week that FC Cincinnati had requested $136 million from the state. That comes from a new grant program that the state has created. And that is what they call unclaimed funds. And these are, it's basically property that is ultimately taxpayer money, but has not been claimed. It can be money in safe deposit boxes, security deposits, paychecks, all these types of things that the state ultimately gets access for if people haven't claimed them. A lot of times it's because it's in somebody's estate and nobody ever bothered to claim it. But at any rate, there is a grant program and it is designed for things like this. So I think FC Cincinnati believes they have a real good chance at getting that money.
And this mixed-use development project next to TQL Stadium, we've heard about this for some time now, but when is work on that actually expected to start?
Yeah, they the FC Cincinnati people told me they plan to break ground this summer, and it's about a 2-year project, Chad Munitz told me. And so I guess we can expect hopefully sometime around 2028 to see the mixed use project. And just to make sure people are aware, it's a pretty major project. It involves two 14-story towers, a lot of apartments, a hotel, an entertainment venue. And on the ground floor, there will be the team store and offices, as well as bars and restaurants. So it's a pretty major project that's really going to change that segment of the West End and neighboring over the Rhine and downtown.
And that's a big deal for the West End and really Cincinnati as a whole. What does this project mean for this city and TQL Stadium? Because really that stadium is, you know, it's nice and new still, but really there's not other events outside of soccer there. So with this kind of renovation and redo, is there an expectation that more things are going to be happening at TQL?
Absolutely. That's one of the main things that the people at FC Cincinnati talked about. And a big reason for these projects at the actual stadium itself that I talked about earlier, things like more premium seating and improving amenities. The Miami UC football game this fall will be there. Major League Soccer is changing its schedule by quite a bit to align with international soccer leagues. So the MLS season beginning next summer, really, in 2027, will start in July and end in May. And so that opens up the off season of very likely from about the beginning of May through mid-July. So a pretty big chunk of the summer where TQL Stadium could be used for a lot of different things, concerts, international exhibition and friendly matches, soccer-wise. The Rugby World Cup may be coming here, some of the matches in 2031. So having the off-season in the summer instead of in January and February really opens up that stadium to a lot more outside use, as you mentioned.
And, you know, that area is being redeveloped in the West End. Also next door, the Town Center Garage. I know the idea of building a new arena there has been floated. What have you heard about that? And generally, what do people in the West End think about all this redevelopment?
Yeah, the that area is certainly considered one of a few options for a new arena. And that still all definitely remains to be seen. Nothing's been decided on that by any means. But that is one of the options. There are a few others around downtown. You know, that would really increase the activity, the traffic, the parking needs, all of that for that West End neighborhood, because that would only be a couple of blocks away from TQL Stadium. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but it would require quite a bit of activity to make it work. The people in the West End, there was a study out recently, they seem kind of mixed about it. So it's certainly not like they are all in on, hey, let's get an arena in our neighborhood. Some people seem to want it. A pretty good chunk are either lukewarm or opposed. And I'm sure that will be a major topic, too, because it's really the only area of the proposed arena sites that is pretty heavily residential right within a block or two.
We are talking with Steve Watkins. Shifting now from one Cincinnati staple to another, Kroger has a new CEO, Greg Foran, and he spoke publicly for the first time this week about his plans for the company. First off, Steve, what kind of company is he walking into, and what are the challenges facing Kroger today?
Yeah, well, Kroger has had quite a few challenges, and really in the past year to year and a few months, they were trying to do the biggest grocery acquisition in history, a $25 billion deal to buy Albertsons, which is a rival in a lot of Kroger's markets, especially in the West. And that deal in December of 2024 was called off after two judges ruled that it violated antitrust rules. That by itself didn't totally call off the deal, but it would have made a lot more hoops they would have had to clear. And both sides called it off the next day. Lawsuits followed. Albertson's lawsuit against Kroger is still pending. Then in March last year, so just about a year ago, Rodney McMullen, the CEO, resigned suddenly after the board found that he had personal conduct that violated the company's ethics policy. So that added to the turmoil of a company that was just recovering from about 2 years of trying to do an enormous acquisition and trying to work with regulators and all that. A lot of that was distracting. Kroger's numbers weren't quite as good as they had been. They lost market share during a lot of that time. And the interim CEO, Ron Sargent, who had been on the board for many years, did implement some significant changes in the past year. But now Greg Foran comes in. He was hired effective February 10th. He was at Walmart, heading up their U.S. operations, a lot of which included their grocery, for about six years at Walmart. And then most recently, he was CEO of Air New Zealand, which he is from New Zealand. And now he comes here very highly regarded.
And he is coming from outside of the company. So what did he say were some of Kroger's major strengths?
Yeah, that's a good point, too. He is actually the first Kroger CEO to come from outside the company. And Kroger's been around since 1883, so that's pretty significant. So I'm glad you pointed that out. Yesterday he talked on Kroger's conference call, which they do each quarter when they report earnings. They reported their fourth quarter earnings yesterday. Greg Foran had only been at the company 23 days. I thought he might just make a few comments and, you know, leave it at that. But he talked, I would say, more than any of the Kroger executives, despite that short amount of time during the call. He talked about several things, very, very clear about his priorities. He talked about the need for better pricing, cutting costs, building customer value, driving faster growth. I mean, he very flatly stated, we need to grow sales faster. But he didn't sound like we need to clean house. In fact, a couple of times he said very clearly that Kroger has a lot of strengths. He's very encouraged by what's going on at Kroger. It was more like building on Kroger's strengths and doing things like some of the things Ron Sargent did with e-commerce to boost that. Greg Foran said that's a good base and a good start, and we need to do that stuff faster. Same with pricing. And he's very big on store quality. He talked about the importance of fresh products like produce and how that can impact the shopper's willingness to return or not.
And you mentioned that competitive pricing there. That is outlined in his strategy for the company. Why is competitive pricing so important?
Well, and that's always a tricky one. On the one hand, as a store, a chain, and Kroger is the biggest grocery store chain in the country for as far as traditional grocery stores, that the chain obviously needs to make money and wants to have a little bit of a profit margin there. But if they raise prices too much, shoppers aren't going to come back, and that's going to hurt business a lot more. So there is a fine line there to walk. And that's why he talked about cutting costs too. If you cut costs, you can cut prices more and still have a decent profit margin. And that's really his goal. In fact, he said very clearly that he does definitely intend to maintain Kroger's profit margin, even as it's keeping prices down. So, like I said, it's a fine line to walk, but it's very important because as many of your listeners will know, there is a point where if prices get too high, they're going to go find somewhere else, whether it's a discount grocer or whatever the case may be.
Well, he's a Kiwi and he's been on the job less than a month. Has he relocated from New Zealand yet? And has he officially moved into the role?
He has officially moved into the role. That was the announcement. He moved into the role effective February 10th. The announcement actually came out the day before, and the news leaked out the day before that, February 8th, which happened to be Super Bowl Sunday. And that was not purposeful, the news did leak out. Kroger announced it the next day. So he's in the role. I don't know that he has moved here yet. He didn't get into that, but I know I wrote a big cover story on his arrival the week after he was hired. And at the time, Kroger said he will move here. He will be located in this office. He talked about being here physically. He was in Kroger's headquarters, it sounded like yesterday. But as far as relocating here, I think that will probably take a little bit more time as far as his residence.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what's coming. You know, you've been on this. What will you be watching from Kroger as they transition with this new CEO?
It'll be very interesting to watch. One of the analysts I talked to when I wrote that cover story said there are going to be nonstop changes for the next couple of years. So it was kind of a fasten your seatbelt type thing. So that's one thing to watch is whether there are significant changes that are big and noticeable, or if it is more just, hey, prices are down a little, and over time, some of these things take effect. He does not seem like the type of person that is going slowly and conservatively into things, though. It seems like he mentioned several times he's been in the food industry for decades. I think he knows what he wants. And so a lot of things we'll have to watch for is how he handles things like e-commerce, like store quality and pricing. And I think those things will come out probably relatively quickly over the next couple of quarters. That might not sound quick to some people, but when you're running a company of about $150 billion in revenue and 2,700 plus stores, that's pretty quick. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens the next couple of quarters as they report results and talk more about the future.
Steve Watkins on it for the Business Courier. Steve, always good to hear from you. Thank you for being here.
No problem, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. And on the ones and twos is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Zach Carrion, filling in for Lucy May. Have a great weekend, everybody.